This is Progressive Radio, a weekly conversation hosted by Matthew Rothschild, editor of The Progressive Magazine, a leading voice for peace and social justice. For more information about Progressive Radio or The Progressive Magazine, log on to our website at progressive.org.
I'm Matt Rothschild, and welcome to Progressive Radio, which you can also grab off our website over at progressive.org. Today, I'm really pleased to have in the studio with me James Carroll, the great columnist for the Boston Globe and prize-winning author of a couple books. He's written a lot of books, actually, An American Requiem, God, My Father, and the War That Came Between Us. He also wrote another book about war called House of War, The Pentagon and the Disastrous Rise of American Power, which was largely about the Bush administration, but about the larger issues of the Pentagon dictating policy. He writes a lot about religion also. He wrote a huge book on Christianity and Judaism called Constantine's Sword, which was made into a documentary. His newest book is called Jerusalem, Jerusalem, the ancient city that ignited the modern world. James Carroll, welcome to Progressive Radio.
Matt, it's an honor to be here.
Honor's mine. I've been reading you at commondreams.org a lot, too, and My brother has been pushing your work on me for a decade now, and I'm grateful to him for that.
So. Thank you.
Tell me a little bit about your background.
Well, wow. Where to start? The great privilege I feel is that I am sort of exactly the age of what I think of as the new age. I was born in the middle of World War II. My first awareness as a kid was, I think, very much tied to the beginning of the Cold War, the Korean War. My father was in the military. We lived in Washington. My dad worked at the Pentagon. I played in the Pentagon as a child. Used to slide down the ramps of the Pentagon in my stocking feet.
I read about that in House of War.
Yes, House of War is a long history of the Pentagon, but it's very personal. It could be called my House of War. I was born on the day that the Pentagon was dedicated. The same week, one week in January of 1943, the Pentagon was dedicated. Los Alamos opened. Roosevelt and Churchill declared a policy of unconditional surrender. And Curtis LeMay led the first bombing raid against a German population center. The beginning of the mass bombing of civilians, nuclear weapons, a bureaucracy to depersonalize and make it amoral.
And these have kind of haunted you your whole adult life.
And
right?
I was born.
Yeah.
You know? And I'm that age. And so I grew up in Washington. My dad came into the peak of his power during the Vietnam War. He was the founding director of the Defense Intelligence Agency, which used to seem mammoth and massive, but of course the DIA is dwarfed now by the massive, unbelievably frightening expansion of American intelligence since the 9/11 strike. But then, of course, that meant that I was a young Catholic seminarian. I was a religious boy. I embraced the vocation of the priesthood.
Did you get that from your parents? They were both
My parents were
religious?
Typical Irish Catholics, not particularly pious, believing, certainly, and loyal to the church. And we were of that age, that American Catholic experience that was defined by the coming of John Kennedy. Kennedy was my family hero, of course, and my father's mentor, in a way, gave my father his position. But at the head of DIA, it meant he was choosing targets in Vietnam. I was the wrong kind of Catholic priest. I associated with the Berrigan wing of the Catholic Peace Movement, Daniel and Philip Berrigan, friends and mentors of mine, and I came into a terrible conflict with my dad, which turned out to be a life-shaping crisis. I left the priesthood. I'm still a Catholic, but I'm a dissenting, resisting, objecting Catholic, the way I'm a dissenting, resisting, objecting American. Same thing.
Did you reach resolution with your dad?
Unfortunately, no. The wound between us went very deep. It's a bit of a mystery. It's what I wrote about in American Requiem. Although at the very end, there was this odd kind of reconciliation, which was he descended into the terrible senility of Alzheimer's. So he didn't know me anymore. And that meant that I could actually come into his presence without him turning red. I could shave him. I could bathe him. I could care for him as I had learned from my children to care for the basic needs of a human person. And that was deeply consoling. So the last year and a half or two of his life, I really was able to put into practice my deep and abiding love for him, quite simply meeting his physical needs and holding his hand and telling him the story of his life as I came to understand it, which was a great life. You know, the great tragedy of my relationship with my dad was, and perhaps not too untypically, as a member of the peace movement, I had kind of a demonized notion of what the Pentagon was. I was at the mercy of the radical division between good and evil. We're the good guys, they're the bad guys. I thought that the Pentagon was populated by war criminals. I thought my father was a war criminal. What I didn't know, and only learned later, too late, was that inside the Pentagon there was a really massive war going on over the conduct of the war in Vietnam, but even more over the Pentagon's disposition toward nuclear weapons. For example, I learned from Robert McNamara's memoir in retrospect that one of the things that made him most anxious and kind of crazy, I think, was the recommendations he was getting from generals like Curtis LeMay to use nuclear weapons in Vietnam, especially as it was more and more clear that we were not going to win that war. And the question of escalating to the point of nuclear use was live. It was real. And that on the heels of a ready impulse to use nuclear weapons against the Soviet Union in preemptive strikes. Live, real. And what I discovered was my dad was on the anti-nuke side of that debate. He was opposed to the Curtis LeMay impulses.
So that must have been comforting to you, too.
Well, it was in effect. I mean, my dad, McNamara reports that he broke with the idea of escalation in 67. He left office in the beginning of 68, you may remember. And the reason he gave for breaking with the idea of escalation against Westmoreland, and Lyndon Johnson went with Westmoreland and against McNamara, who began to say no to escalation. And the reason he gave was because of the DIA reports he was getting from my father. And my father was clear in indicting the Air Force Air War campaign against North Vietnam as saying it was stiffening the will of the North Vietnamese. It was not breaking their will, which was the theory behind it, of course. And my dad was an Air Force man, and he betrayed the Air Force in his DIA assessments. My father ended his career opposed to Melvin Laird, who was claiming that new intelligence justified the resuscitation of something you may remember, the anti-ballistic missile. Nixon and Laird in 1969 wanted to bring back what the Johnson administration had rejected, which was the ABM. It was unnecessary, it was unworkable, and it was a major escalation in the arms race with the Soviets. Laird said before Congress that his intelligence established that the Soviets had changed their strategic strategy and were now going for a first strike. Therefore, we needed the ABM. And my father, as the head of DIA, and presumably, therefore, the source of this intelligence, was called to testify. And he was asked point blank if he was the source of Laird's testimony or Laird's new intelligence. And he said no. And he said further that there was no new intelligence and that, this, as far as he knew, the Soviet strategic doctrine had not changed. Within a week, my father was forcibly retired. His career was over.
I couldn't have one of many friends in the Pentagon.
Well, and of course, we live in an era when one catastrophe after another has followed the politicization of intelligence. Intelligence officers telling their civilian bosses what they want to hear. That's what got us into Iraq and Afghanistan. The point is that I didn't know any of this. And it was only after my father and I were broken and after he had moved into the cloud of senility that I began to learn the real story of my father's life. He was not a peacenik by any stretch, and he was dead set against my attitudes. But in his own terms, in the most important argument of the 20th century on nuclear weapons, he was quite heroic. And it both fills me with gratitude, but also grief that he and I were not able to reconcile over it.
I'm speaking with James Carroll, the great columnist for the Boston Globe. You're listening to Progressive Radio. I'm Matt Rothschild, the editor at the Progressive. Isn't it amazing that nuclear weapons are still on hair trigger alert?
It's astonishing. You know, American complacency toward nuclear weapons is going to be one of the great conundrum of historians in the future. When historians look back on this period, especially if the worst happens, if there's a nuclear exchange, for example, between India and Pakistan, or if these newfangled drone weapon systems become in some way nuclear armed with miniature nuclear systems, who knows what's ahead. Historians are going to be baffled by the American complacency toward the nuclear arsenal at the end of the Cold War, that we still have thousands of nuclear weapons in this country, that the military doctrine is underway now to not only renew them but to replace them, new generations of nuclear weapons. The American people completely blasé about it, not a political issue. It's never brought up in mainstream political argument. It's not on the question between Republicans and Democrats, and it hasn't been for decades. The last American president to actually make an issue of nuclear weapons was Ronald Reagan, who was, by the end of his time, a nuclear abolitionist. Ronald Reagan, a nuclear abolitionist, a man who said these things are evil, wicked, they must be gotten rid of. Where is that Ronald Reagan in the American political memory? It's astonishing and it's tragic.
Yeah, I'm reminded of the old peace activist Sam Day, who used to work for the Progressive magazine, the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists, said at some point there's going to be another nuclear war and we're going to look back and just be shocked. And I think there's a real naivete here in the United States about nuclear weapons, because the fear of an all-out nuclear war is receding because Russia isn't such a threat right now. But I just saw something from Physicians for Social Responsibility, a study done of what would happen if India and Pakistan have a war, and it will bring on nuclear winter and the end of the world, really.
It's true. It's true. Again, the word that comes to mind is complacency. It's criminal complacency. We have amnesia in this country. We can't reckon with Hiroshima, with its meaning. And we can't reckon with what the Cold War was. The myth that America, quote, won the Cold War reinforces us in our lack of need to be self-critical. The astonishing fact of American liberal politics is that the American nuclear arsenal was cut in half by Ronald Reagan and George H.W. Bush. Under Bill Clinton, the nuclear arsenal wasn't reduced at all. And by the time George W. Bush became president, it was gone as an issue in American politics.
James Carroll, why do you say it's a myth that the U.S. didn't win the Cold War, or that the U.S. won the Cold War?
Well, there's an insistence, of course, in the political mainstream that the U.S. won the Cold War. We outspent the genius Reagan escalations of the military budget, drove the fragile Soviet economy into a wall. The Soviets were beaten by our superior military technology and our way out spending them. They just couldn't keep up with us. They finally had no choice but to quit. That's just simply wrong. They had another choice, an altogether other choice, the one that empires have made again and again and again down through the centuries, which is in a period of decline. There's no doubt the Soviets were in an economic crunch, and they were also – their economy was – being destroyed by their inability to cope with the innovations of technology and so forth. But in periods of decline, empires instinctively, traditionally reach out even more to demonize the enemy, to blame the situation on the enemy. If Yuri Andropov had lived, or if instead of Gorbachev coming to power, another figure like Andropov had come to power, we'd have had a very different denouement of the Cold War. Gorbachev is the great fluke of history. We could use another Gorbachev in world politics today, someone who is capable of looking at the reality of the situation, not that Gorbachev wanted to preside over the end of communism or the end of the Soviet Empire, but looking at the reality of the situation, seeing the monstrous possibilities of the meaning of a war with the West, and also understanding the likelihood of that if the Soviet economic decline was to run unchecked, did what had to be done, which was make this magnificent approach to Ronald Reagan in such a way that Reagan couldn't say no to it. Gorbachev was the man who refused to take no for an answer, and Reagan was won over by him. And it's one of the great American stories that the Hawk of Hawks should become the guy who stops nuclear escalation and begins the reversal of the nuclear arms race in partnership with Mikhail Gorbachev. And that alone trumps even the terribly devastating, damaging effects of Reagan's 8 years on, for example, the American economy and the plight of the working class and the middle class in this country. Reaganomics as the beginning of the economic meltdown that we're traumatized by right now. Horrible as all of that is, and wrong-headed as so many of Reagan's policies were, the fact that that man found it possible to say yes to Gorbachev stands as one of the great events of the 20th century.
And speaking of flukes of history, you wrote somewhere that Gorbachev was able to step back from a huge military response because of that guy who flew that light plane into Moscow.
Yeah, Matthew Rust was a German, young German kid in his early 20s, had a plane like a Cessna, flew it low through all of the massive and expensive Soviet air defense systems, all the way to from West Germany all the way to Moscow, and landed in Red Square. People ought to remember this. And what did Gorbachev do? It was right at the beginning of Gorbachev's time as premier. What did he do? He fired several hundred senior Russian military officials, outraged at their failure to protect the homeland. And in one fell swoop, he rid himself of the bureaucratic establishment that would have made his policies of disarmament they would have made it impossible. So Matthew Rust is somebody who deserves to be remembered. The other thing about Gorbachev, of course, was that he didn't want any of the changes that he wound up presiding over. He was just sensitive to the currents of history, and that's actually the most important definition of leadership.
I'm speaking with James Carroll. He's the great columnist for the Boston Globe, the author of House of War, American Requiem, the one about his dad, Constantine Sword, maybe his most famous book. His newest book is called Jerusalem, Jerusalem, the Ancient City that Ignited the Modern World. Tell me about that and what you're driving at in that book.
Well, I begin with a preoccupation shared by many people with the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. I work in history. I'm an historian, and it became very clear to me that to really get a hold of this dilemma, one has to go back into history. And the farther back I pushed, the farther back I went. And the next thing you know, I'm looking at the prehistoric sources of sacrifice. Religious sacrifice is the generating idea of Jerusalem, and that's relevant because basic ideas of sacrifice still inform American and world attitudes, Israeli and Palestinian attitudes, toward military violence. It's possible to think you're enacting something virtuous or good by killing. That's the core idea of sacrifice. Jerusalem is the heart of it. Jerusalem was the cockpit of violence in the biblical times. There's no surprise, really, that Jerusalem should still be a center of contention because that's what it's always been. The empires of history have intersected in Jerusalem. The good news about Jerusalem is that it's a place where human beings again and again and again have found ways to mitigate violence. The Bible itself tells the story of violence from the point of view of the victim, not the oppressor. Jesus comes out of that tradition. Muhammad is appealed to by it. The shorthand word for this source of peace and compassion is oneness. The oneness of God is the religious idea. Jerusalem is the center of this oneness. And now the tragedy, the irony is that Israelis and Palestinians, precisely because they share reverence for the holy city, are locked in this seemingly intractable conflict over who owns it.
Yeah, they're each claiming their own oneness. You have a different concept of oneness.
That's true, and which is why each religious tradition, certainly the three monotheistic traditions, have to understand the ongoing obligation to be self-critical. I'm approaching these questions as a Christian. It's not my job to tell Jews and Muslims what's wrong with their traditions. My job is to look at my own tradition and be critical about it. So therefore, for example, instead of just impatiently condemning Israel or Palestine for the intractability of this conflict, I see them as locked in a corner in this deadly conflict with one another. The rest of us stand outside the corner and say, why can't these two end this conflict? It's obvious what the end game is. It's obvious what the resolution requires. Why don't they just stop it? They don't stop it because they're trapped in a corner, the walls of which they didn't create, and that still have overwhelming power over both of them. One wall, the long Christian tradition of anti-Semitism. The other wall, the long European Christian tradition of white racist colonialism. Jews on the one side, Arab Muslims on the other, Arab Christians as well. Colonialism, anti-Semitism, two great legacies of the West that have yet to be fully reckoned with. Europeans and Americans have an obligation to reckon with both. And until colonialism, Orientalism in Edward Said's word, and anti-Semitism are unpacked, dismantled, dispatched, there won't be the kind of peace in Israel-Palestine that we're all looking for. Meanwhile, the dynamics of the Western world seem disastrously focused there. On the one side, the Arab world having embraced the worst of the traditions of anti-Semitism that were originated with the Christian world, even though they're foreign to Islam and to the Arab culture generally. And on the other side, Israel having embraced a kind of what you'd have to call as a typical superpower military belligerence. Zionism set out to create a Jewish state that would be like other states, normal. And that's the good news. The bad news is it is normal. So you get in Israel attitudes not unlike you get in Washington, with the particular manifestation, again, going back to our earlier point, around nuclear weapons. So the Israeli nuclear arsenal is now a generating center for the potential cascade of nuclear proliferation in the Middle East. So what the short of it is, Israel and Palestine are not in a conflict in a vacuum. It's a vacuum that belongs to the West. All of us have some reckoning to do with it. And even as we take our positions about it, look for the ways we can support justice for the Palestinians, security for the State of Israel, we have to also reckon with the ways in which the rest of us have been part of this problem.
Speaking with James Carroll, columnist for the Boston Globe, author of Constantine's Sword and Jerusalem, Jerusalem, his most recent book, The Ancient City That Ignited the Modern World. Boy, if we have to wait till we unpack colonialism and anti-Semitism to solve the Israeli-Palestinian problem, it's going to go on for a long, long time.
Well, which is why we should be more attentive to the idea of truce. Truce is not a bad place to start. My hope for Israel-Palestine is not a final settlement, a comprehensive peace that doesn't seem on the horizon. A serious recommitment to truce would be a nice place to start.
How do we get to there?
Well, on the Israeli side, nothing happens until the settlements stop. The expansion of settlements, especially in Jerusalem, new expansions announced just a couple of weeks ago. And on the Palestinian side, a firm and clear reckoning with the absolute right of Israel to be there, of the Jewish state to be there. Those two principles are the issues over which there's an impasse now. my own strong conviction is that both sides see more clearly than ever that the status quo is going to be catastrophic. It can't continue. I think Israel reckons with that more and more. The future of the democratic character of the state is at issue. And for Palestinians, the thriving economy of the West Bank and the disaster of impoverishment in Gaza, both of which have to be set free from the occupation. So some settlement has to be achieved. And I'm a hopeful person.
It is frustrating to watch. Excuse me for interrupting, though, because as you say, the ultimate settlement likelihood, the lines of that settlement have been pretty obvious for 25 years now.
It's true. It's true. The lesson of history is moments come that can be seized. The Arab Spring was such a moment. I'm sure that's part of what's energizing Palestinians now. Occupy Wall Street suggests the possibility of such a moment in the United States of America. There's a version of it underway in Israel and Tel Aviv. Actually, I'm sure that one of the influences in the Occupy Wall Street movement was the Occupy Tel Aviv movement of young Israelis. History has a way of presenting us with yet another opportunity. I think it's coming. I'm hoping it can be seized.
Howard Zinn called this the flash of the possible. Moments come. Talk about the Occupy Wall Street phenomenon and how you assess it.
Well, there are many ways to talk about it. I'm no expert, but the thing that's most striking to me about it is the clear demand we hear from 20-somethings. It's true that there's a whole range of people who have been punished and oppressed by the American economic system, the abused so-called underclass of our culture, the permanently poor, poorer than ever, of course, old people who can't live without choosing between medicine and food. But the 20-somethings are the ones who really seem to have found their voice in this thing. These are young people, many of them, who have accepted the American bargain. They were told, go to school, be diligent in school, and then be responsible when you get out of school, and you will find a meaningful and happy life. And it's not happened. And that we've said to hell with it to a whole American generation. People in their 20s are burdened by the educations they were diligent about getting. They have to pay for them with savage debt. And there is nothing for them to do with their knowledge and their skill. And the country is basically saying, so what? Tough it out. Suck it up. And if you're unemployed until the next recovery comes and the jobs you are desperate to get go to the people who are younger than you, too bad. You're the lost generation. You're this century's lost generation. They're saying no to that. And they're saying no with great power, great dignity, and great peacefulness. It's a good thing.
I think it's a good thing, too, and I love the way you expressed it. James Carroll has been my guest today on Progressive Radio. He's the columnist for the Boston Globe and author most recently of Jerusalem, Jerusalem. You can read him on commondreams.org a lot, too. James Carroll, it's been a pleasure to finally meet you after reading you for so many years.
Thank you, Matt.
Today's program is available online at progressive.org. You can also write to us at 409 East Main Street, Madison, Wisconsin, 53703. Our music is by Mufa. Progressive Radio is produced by Elizabeth DiNovella and engineered at Audio for the Arts in Madison, Wisconsin.